Good morning. And again, we're starting with the mic muted. Okay, good morning. So last time we talked a bit about assembly. We mentioned this idea of AT&T syntax, so the other syntax, the one, as the name suggests, which comes from AT&T, back when AT&T was a Unix company among many other things. And in this syntax, probably the most obvious immediate difference you see is that the destination is last. We also have this very different syntax for specifying addresses. Sort of the most general form was we had displacement, which was sort of a number to add to the address, a base, which was a register, an index, which was a register, and This is what happens when I'm not paying attention when I'm writing my slides. So I'll have to update that. And a scale. Someone was thinking of things we're going to cover. And caches. And decided to use a cache vocab term instead of the actual one. Okay. So base, index, and a scale. Not an offset. I don't know why I wrote that, but it's not right. Scale. And the calculation is displacement plus the base plus the index times the scale, where base and index are registers. So we saw that we had to use a dollar sign to represent constants. So if we just had a bare number, the bare number was considered a version of this displacement base index scale syntax where we just didn't mention the base, index, or scale. And in general, we have all these versions of that displacement base index scale syntax where you can omit various parts, and there's just a relatively straightforward default value, usually 0. Sometimes for scale, 0 doesn't really make sense, so 1. We also talked a bit about how labels work. So labels, which are in assembly, the name for when you have something in assembly where you kind of mark an instruction with something with a colon, like used for functions or things you jump to. That's a label. And you often use that label, like if you say jump to foo. Or we saw that this was also used, like if you have a global variable. The global variable will have a label, so you'll have like the string will have a label here. So this is our label, and later on we might use that label to figure out where the string is. And the way these work in assembly, is that basically you can think of the label as being replaced with the address of the thing that is being labeled. So when I use this move here, where I have move this thing called str somewhere, that's going to be replaced with the actual address of str. And in this context, I put a dollar sign in front of it, so it's going to be interpreted as a constant. But it's going to be the same, you know, as if I wrote something like dollar sign 1234, assuming 1234 is where that string ends up. Okay. So then we also talked a bit about the calling convention. And so we mentioned sort of the registers used for arguments. What call and return do and do not do. So we said call and return. Call pushes the place we went to go back to on the stack and jumps to the function. Return pops the thing that hopefully call pushed on the stack and jumps there. Return doesn't actually do anything with the return value, like what the function returns, if it like returns a number. That is just done by convention that we know the code it returns to is going to expect to look in a particular place on our Linux systems and RAX. There's nothing that the return instruction does to make that happen. That all happens because of what the code it returns to does. And we also, as part of our convention, in just deciding what registers are used for arguments and the return value, we need to know about sort of who saves what register values. And we need to know this because when you call a function, you need to know, you know, if I care about some register not changing after the function call, is that my responsibility or is that the function I'm calling's responsibility? And the calling conventions just have someone made a decision for that, and all the compilers and library writers and so on follow it. And finally, we started LEA, the load effective address instruction, which will be our first thing for today. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Oh. Okay, so I'm gonna, before I talk about LEA, I'm gonna do a bit of logistics stuff. So one thing we're gonna do is talk about quizzes. So we mentioned last week that we're gonna have weekly quizzes starting after this lecture. That will be due before the next lecture, which will be on the week's lecture material, generally. And they're going to be taken online. So there's a quiz site, which is linked from the course website. And did I put it here? Yes, okay. So we're going to show you what that looks like. So this is not the quiz site we're using, but our quiz site will look very similar. This is my demo quiz site. So when you take a quiz, you'll get to, you might have a prompt that I don't have in this case, but you'll get to a page like this when you open the quiz, and you're going to enter your answers on the question. So when I enter an answer, the box around the question will turn green. If that happens, your answer is recorded. If you're not sure what answers you have recorded, if you reload the quiz page, it should show you the answers that are recorded. Or if you can go back to the index and load it. You can also type a comment. So you can say here, for example, if you think we made an error in the question, or the question is missing information you need to know about your answer. And we will have someone read the comments and adjust your grade accordingly. Generally, we won't be able to answer questions about the quiz questions while the quiz is out. The main reason for this is that, if we answer a question on Monday, that's really not nice for someone who took the quiz on Friday. If I send out an email to the class on Monday saying, sorry, people who took the quiz on Friday, you now have to go back to it even though you probably took it on Friday because you have classes on Monday. So instead, we'll deal with the question as written. If the question's really bad, we'll drop it. If it's not so bad, we might accept additional answers or something like that. Generally, when you write a comment, so if you think the question has an error, explain what you think your best guess as to an answer is, or what assumptions you would need to make and how that affects the answer. And, if it seems like when we have some grader looking at it that you understand what the question is trying to ask about, you should get credit. And when the box is orange, it's not recorded. If you switch to another input box, it will turn green, and that means everything is recorded. If it doesn't turn green, then it's not recorded, your Wi-Fi isn't working or our server isn't working. So we'll have multiple choice questions. For multiple select all that apply questions like this, generally each option is worth some number of points. So yes, there are points for leaving everything blank often. We also have short answer questions where you could write something here. So, and select one questions. Okay, so questions about sort of entering the quiz and yes. Question, if you leave the page, you automatically submit. When the box around the question turns green, that answer has been submitted. And you can come back to it at any time, and we will take whatever was the last thing you submitted before the quiz is due. Does that answer your question? And after the quiz is due, we will show it graded, like you see here. And you can see here my answers. You can see marked with a T here the answers on our answer key. And the percentages are the percent of students who gave each of those answers, so you could have an idea how confusing the multiple choice questions were. And if you've given a comment and a grader has looked at it, they might have some feedback for you, which you can see here. And there's a place to submit regrade requests, which we will eventually look at. Note that for comments, the quizzes will be auto-graded just after it's due, but obviously we don't read the comments, you know, in the 1 minute between when the quiz is due and lecture. So you should expect, you know, a few days for us to actually, or maybe about a week for us to read your comments and adjust your grade for that. If after that you think we made an error, let us know and we'll take a look at it at some point. So, questions about sort of quiz logistics? Okay, and the quiz site, so people find it. There's the link here that goes to our quiz site, which is not the one I was showing you because I'm not going to show you quizzes that aren't released. Okay. Everyone. Okay, so so one other note. So if you look at the schedule, our first lab is next week, so it's the bomb lab, and there's a corresponding homework. So you should go. So we expect the bomb lab is something you can do during lab. I expect that the infrastructure for it, however, will be available starting tomorrow. If you've tried to start it early, you probably noticed that you can't actually get the binary bomb program, so you probably couldn't do very much on it. What the lab is going to do is we're going to have you get a program that you have to figure out what the input is that makes it not explode. So it's a bomb, and when you do that, it's going to send that input to our server, and we'll use that to give you a grade saying you completed it. And it has multiple phases. For the lab, you have to do the first phase. For the homework, you have to do phases 2 and 3, and there's a very tiny amount of extra credit for doing the remaining phases. So, and questions on that? And our review of assembly should help you with dealing with the debugger and reading it, because you do not have the full source code for that program. We will give you the main file, and that's it. Okay, so back to talking about assembly. So when we finished up last time, we started talking about LEA. So I said that this is kind of like a move, but it skips the memory access. So whereas if we were doing a move of 4 RAX into RAX, this would be reading from memory at 4 plus RAX. The LEA just computes that address and then puts it in RAX. So this is kind of like what you might imagine the address of operator in C. We don't move the actual value there, we move its address. So kind of the computation we're doing here is we're taking, in both cases, we're computing RAX plus 4. The difference is whether we're accessing memory there or not. So LEA, you can think of kind of like a move from memory that skips the memory part. It just gets the address we would access memory at, shoves it in. One way to kind of remember this is what the term effective address means and how this is named. So effective address in an instruction is the computed address for what the instruction's work is. So if an instruction has to compute a memory address and go to the memory, that address it computes is called the effective address. So load effective address computes the address we would go to for memory and just loads it into the destination register. It doesn't actually. And what tends to confuse people about LEA the most is that it's kind of defined in terms of memory accesses, but because the processor never actually talks to the memory, it doesn't care if the memory address is valid or not. So what we finished last time, this example here. So this LEA RAX, RAX, 4, into RAX. This is a way of multiplying RAX times 5. Why does that work? Because, well, if you think of this as the first part as a memory access, we're accessing memory at RAX plus RAX times 4. We do some distributive property. We get RAX times 5. And this is often what compilers will generate if you write X times 5. Because it, in fact, is the fastest way of doing it on most current x86 processors. And you might say, but X might not be a valid memory address. X times 5 wouldn't be a valid memory address. Well, the processor doesn't care. All it's doing is computing a number, and it's not going to notice it's not a valid memory address unless it tries to actually access memory with it. So it doesn't matter that it looks like this instruction is supposed to be for memory addresses, you know, because that only comes up if we actually access memory. And similarly, we have this example here where I can use LEA to add two values together. So in this case, I add RBX and RCX into RDX. And this is something a compiler might do instead of an add instruction. You might say, well, why? And if you think of how we'd write this without LEA, how would we write this with an add instruction? Someone want to tell me? What would be the way to write this with an add instruction? Yeah?
It would be add to RBX, percent sign RBX, comma, percent sign RDX, and then a separate instruction.
So you're saying add Q RBX RCX? Is that your first instruction?
Or RDX.
RDX, okay. And then?
The second one is add Q RCX.
Okay, so this is not quite what that does. Not quite equivalent. You're right that we need two instructions, because we need to do something with RDX, right? That's a problem, right? We can't write one instruction most of the time on x86 that deals with three different registers. But what this does is it adds RBX and RCX. It doesn't add RDX as part of the sum. So we don't actually want to add involving RDX. So can someone tell me what the correction is for that? Yeah? Our first instruction could just be a move? Yeah. So that would take care of it. So what this lets us get rid of is a move. So the compiler might generate this because it avoids a move instruction. Yeah?
Sorry, can you repeat again why you can't do the two adds?
Why I can't do the two adds?
Yeah.
So this doesn't compute, this doesn't add RBX, RCX, and RDX together. It only adds the value of RBX and RCX. The prior value of RDX doesn't matter. It overwrites RDX entirely. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
So LEA will just
So LEA will just take the memory address that's computed and place it there, and move will access memory and place the value it finds from memory there? Yes. Yeah?
If you did LEA in the first argument, didn't have the parentheses around it, it would find, like, say you did LEA RBX RDX.
So question is, what if I did LEA RBX RDX? And this does not assemble. Your assembler will say LEA doesn't make sense with that argument. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions?
move with the dollar sign on the constant integer register the same as LEA, just the number integer?
So the question is, if doing a, say, move of 1, 2, 3, dollar sign 1, 2, 3 into something the same as LEA of 1, 2, 3 into something. And I believe the answer is yes. Other questions? Or at least yes, to the extent that there are valid instructions. I'm not sure if that LEA instruction exists, but if it does, it would do that. Yeah. So the question is, why can't we do the two-add instruction? So I wrote down what this LEA does. Here. There is one add in there. So when I translate it to assembly, I better end up with one add. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So LEA 1, 2, 3, comma, percent sign RCX, that just puts 1, 2, 3 in the memory for RCX.
Question, LEA 1, 2, 3, percent RCX, the instruction I have messily wrote here, that just puts the memory address 1, 2, 3.
It puts it in the memory spot, basically.
It puts it in the memory spot of RCX. So RCX doesn't have a spot in memory. So remember when we drew our diagram of the processor and memory, RCX was this thing on the processor, it's not in memory. But it's going to modify RCX and it's going to put the value 1, 2, 3, because even though the first argument here isn't a constant, this is taking the address of that first argument. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so now that we know about LEA, let's do a little exercise here. And there's one thing I'm going to talk about a bit. And that's, well, LEAL. So remember how I said we had Q for 8 bytes, L for 4 bytes, and so on. So there's a 4-byte version of LEA, and you might say, wait a moment, but addresses are 8 bytes. I know that because we're using RDI, right? We have 8 RDI, we must be using 64 bits addresses. How is there a 4-byte version of LEA? But there is, and what it does is it does the same thing as the 8-byte version does, but it truncates the value it stores in the destination. So it only stores the least significant 4 bytes instead of all 8 bytes. But the address computation, because our addresses are always 64 bits, is done as it happens with 64 bits, which is why the first operand is using RDI and not EDI. So, and some other things. So I mentioned we won't require you to memorize the calling convention. So RDI is the first argument register, or EDI, etc. And RAX, or EAX, I should make this clearly an A, X equals the return value. So, that in mind, question is, what is this function? So what C code would I put in the dot 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 for this function? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree, what's going on. Thank you. Okay, who likes some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? E? Okay, F? No clue? Okay, we have actual consensus for E, which is the correct answer. And I don't know if that's happened before. Lucky time. So what's going on here is our first step, we compute RDI, which is going to be arg times 8 into EAX. So EAX equals arg times 8. And then we do the subtraction. Remember, it's subtract from. So we compute arg times 8, which is EAX, minus arg, which is EDI, into EAX. So our return value ends up being arg times 7. So arg times 7 isn't any of the options. We have the negation of it. And so that would be what this function was. Yes?
Does it not have to be long arg because it's going into RDI?
Question, does it not have to be long arg? So, I think it would be reasonable for it also to have the prototype with a long. I got this actual code by generating it with an int, and because our addresses have to be 64 bits, LEA's first parameter needs to have 64-bit base index, and so on. So, this is what will happen even if it's 32 bits extended to 64 bits. Does that answer your question? Same question? Yes.
What is the 0 for, and what is the missing parameter before the first column?
The question is, in the LEA, what is going on with, why do we have this 0, and what goes in that first blank that is left open? So if you remember our syntax, this 0 here is the displacement that would be added to the address. We're just adding 0 after we do the rest of the computation. I could have omitted it, and it would default to 0. I just was explicit about it. And here, we've omitted the base register. And when it's omitted, it defaults to 0, which it defaults to just using the value 0 instead of a register. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
So I understand that,
question is, why can't I just use EDI and the LEA? Because the first parameter to LEA is an address computation, it has to be with address size values. Because basically, the processor has like a circuit for computing addresses, and we're kind of stealing that to do math. But since it's a circuit for computing addresses, it expects everything to look like addresses from, you know, a very high level view. Does that answer your question? The question is, the LEAL is essentially EDI times 8 because the L means we're truncating to the least significant 32 bits at the end? Yes.
Yeah. So with what you said before, does that mean that within like any LEA instruction, it has to have like 64-bit parameters?
The question is, does that mean that within any LEA instruction it has to have 64-bit parameters? If we specify base or index registers, so these two slots for an LEA, they have to be 64-bit registers. Yeah.
Is this the fastest way to multiply an 8x7?
It's what GCC generates with optimizations on. Whether it's fastest probably depends on exactly which x86 processor you have. But I would guess usually the answer is yes. Yeah.
The first line, what would happen?
Question, what would happen if multiplying RDI by 8 overflowed? So I guess one thing from a practical point of view we know in this case is if the argument's really an int, that's not possible. Because it was 32 bits expanded to 64. So there's no, like, the overflow won't happen. Otherwise, it would overflow, but it would overflow the same way if we were using a normal multiply instruction.
So you just go back to 0 and count up there?
It would effectively wrap around, yes. But it works the same way as a normal multiply because the multiply in the scale calculation is the same as a normal multiply. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is in the higher 4 significant bytes of that register?
What's in the higher 4 significant bytes of EDI?
Yeah.
Of RDI, rather? So because it was set by doing something like, if we imagine the code calling this, like did something like move something EDI, we learned last time that that clears the upper 4 bytes and puts zeros in there. So it should contain zeros, assuming the function actually takes an int parameter. Does that answer your question? Question, if we did LEAQ and did RDI and REX, would you get the same result?
And same thing with subtract.
We would probably, would we get the same, so I think we would get the same result ignoring overflow. If overflow occurred, the value in REX might be a bit different. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's our, okay. And I guess I'm just going to mention that some things exist that we weren't going to cover or not going to cover today. So we haven't ever talked about how to do floating point. Floating point on x86 involves some registers that I'm just going to mention exist, so you know if you see them what's going on. So XMM0 through XMM15 are the registers used for floating point and some other things. There's also something called segmentation. This comes up once in one of the assignments. There's a note in the bomb assignment. You might see some uses of these special registers. They're used for one particular reason, and we have a note in the assignment about what's going on there near the bottom, I believe. Using these DS, FS, or GS registers. And also, there's tons of instructions we've never mentioned, and you can look them up if you need them. I'm not going to go. The x86 has, depending on how you count, like 5,000-ish instructions. So we're not going to talk about them. But we are going to talk about a few, you know, particular topics that are going to come up, especially when we're kind of implementing an x86-like processor. And one of them is how processors deal with conditional operations. And you've learned how to do conditionals in 2150, and most people kind of remember this idea of I do a compare and then some conditional jump. So here, I compare 0 and RAX, and if they're equal, I jump over the call to foo, otherwise the jump doesn't do anything, and I just end up calling foo. So this is a way I can implement that if RAX doesn't equal 0, call foo, otherwise do it. And something that probably you didn't address is, you know, these compare and this jump is equal, they're different instructions. And they're actually separate instructions. We could put instructions in between. What's going to happen if we do that? You know, how does JE know what the compare did? So we're going to talk about that. And the answer is that there are some extra special registers that we haven't talked about yet, called condition codes. And this is where jump if equal is getting the information about whether it is equal or not. And these registers are set by almost all arithmetic instructions. You might be looking at that and saying, wait a moment. But we're using it with compare. It's set by all of them? Yes. So compare is just a special arithmetic instruction. But it turns out that add, subtract, multiply, and so on also set all these condition codes. And these condition codes store information about the last arithmetic operation we did. Like, was it 0? Was it negative? And so on. So you might say, wait a moment. You said we're storing if it's 0, if it's negative. How does that relate to equal, right? Equal is not a result of an arithmetic operation. And the answer is that these conditional jump instructions are named based on interpreting the result of subtraction. So jump if equal is jump if last arithmetic was 0. Because if it was a subtraction and the result was 0, that means that the values we subtracted were equal. And a compare instruction does a subtraction. And jump greater than is jump if it was positive. And since the compare instruction does the subtraction, it tells us the first thing we subtracted was greater than the second. And negative is less than, and so on. Questions about this idea of the relationship between our conditional jump instructions and our last arithmetic result. So I said we store information about the last arithmetic operation, and the processor doesn't like store the actual value we computed. It stores kind of a very short summary. And there's sort of two parts which are going to be most important for us, and these are the names x86 gives them. We have ZF called the zero flag, and SF called the sign flag. So the zero flag is going to be 1 if the result was 0, and 0 otherwise. So basically, every time you do an arithmetic operation, the processor is just going to compare that result to 0 and store it in the zero flag. And then something like jump if equal can check whether we just got a 0 by checking that flag, which is going to be just a 1-bit register. We have the sign flag, which just wasn't negative. And if you remember how choose complements works, we have a sign bit at the beginning of our values. And if it's 1, it was negative. If it's 0, otherwise. So the sign flag is actually just a copy of the sign bit we got for the last time we did arithmetic. So something I'm missing here that is rather important for making comparisons work correctly is dealing with overflow. So for example, if we want compare to work correctly, we want it to be the case that once that subtraction overflows, we still do the right comparison. And the way this is handled is that when we do the arithmetic operation, the processor is going to check if there's overflow. And there's some additional condition codes that we're going to use to deal with that. And on x86, there's an overflow flag, which is tells us, did the operation overflow if we treat the operands as sine numbers? And there's a carry flag, which answers the same question, but did it overflow if we treat it as unsigned numbers? And there are different sets of conditional jumps depending on which of these overflow flags they use. So jump if less than, jump if less than or equal to, and so on, all check for signed overflow, so they assume you did a signed comparison. And jump below or equal, jump above, and so on, all check for the unsigned, the carry flag, so they assume you did an unsigned comparison. And this is going to be part of the difference in what code your compiler generates, depending on whether you're using signed or unsigned numbers. And there's also some more condition codes that we're not going to talk about in this class. Now, obviously, if we're implementing a real processor, getting the overflow flag and the carry flag right is very important. You would be really disappointed if the compare instruction didn't handle overflow. You could deal with it, but it would be annoying. Now, we're going to have a series of assignments later on where we implement a processor. And unlike our textbook, we're only going to implement the zero flag and the sign flag. We're just going to make overflow not do the right thing, just to keep things simpler, because we're not going to care about that case. But obviously, you know, it's kind of important for programs that you might want to write. Support that, but if you're making your processor, sure, it's easier not to have to worry about it. Some questions about our condition codes. Put these flags. Okay, and this is one of the registers you can see in the debugger. So if you go open up GDB and type info registers, you'll see something called eFlags. And this is sort of one big register that has certain bits of it represent each of these flag values. And GDB kind of decodes what those flag values are here. So we can see that the P flag, the zero flag, the ZF, and something, the I flag are set. We haven't talked about what PF or IF are. They aren't relevant yet, at least. And since the sign flag, the overflow flag, and the carry flag are not listed, they are set to zero. Questions? This. Yeah.
Can these flags only be set to 0 or 1?
Can these flags only be set to 0 or 1? Yes, they're 1-bit values. Other questions? Question: are the sign flag, overflow flag, and carry flag also the same register? They're the same. They're this flags register the debugger talks about. Yes. Whether they're implemented in the same register in the processor, we can't tell. Yeah.
If these flags are in the register, they are ones, right? They're not zeros.
So, question: if these flags are in the register and ones are zeros, I would say if they're listed in the output here, they're ones. Other questions? Okay. So let's do some examples of condition codes here. So here, I have some code. I store negative 10 in RAX. I store 20 in RBX. And then I do a subtraction. And remember, the way subtraction works, this is subtract from, so we subtract RAX from RBX, so that's 20 minus negative 10, which is going to give us 30, and we go through our flags. So that's, we have a sign flag. The sign flag is one of its negative. It's a copy of the sign bit. The sign bit for 30 is 0, right? It's a positive number, not negative. And the 0 flag is 0 because it's not 0. So this is going to set SF to 0 and ZF to 0. And the jump less than equal to, well, it's going to be checking for a negative number or zero. So it's going to be looking for, so this is looking for SF equals 1 or ZF equals 1. Because SF equals 1 is negative, ZF equals 1 is 0. And a way we can think of it is that it's comparing the result to 0. So it's jump if result is less than or equal to 0. Yes?
So does GLE just look at like any of the previous registers used, or is it always RAX?
The question, does GLE look at any of the previous registers, or is it always RAX? So GLE is looking at these condition codes, these flags. So what's going to have happened is that the subtract, in addition to this case setting RBX, also set the flags. So we can think that the subtract instruction, what it does is it sets RBX to 30, it sets the zero flag to 0 and the sign flag to 0. It does all three of these assignments at once. Does that answer your question?
What I mean is, like, if instead of RAX, I just said, like, RCX, would it still be the same thing?
So the question, if I replaced RAX here with RCX?
Yeah.
So in that case, we don't know what the value of RCX is.
No, like, if I replaced all the RAXs with RCX,
would it do the same thing? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So all it cares about is these flags, and the subtract just sets it based on what the subtraction did. It doesn't care about where it got the values to subtract. Yes? The question, do the flags reset when we use a conditional jump? No. So the flags generally don't get reset. We just do more arithmetic operations and they get changed. Okay. Other questions? Yeah? Does LEA count as an arithmetic operation? So we'll talk about that explicitly a bit later. The answer is no. And no, that's not intuitive. The way you know that is by looking it up. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we can go through a couple other examples. So we had our 30 gives us SF equals 0 because it's not negative, ZF equals 0 because it's not 0. If we did 20 minus 20, that's going to give us 0. 0 is not negative and has a sign bit of 0. And has a 0 flag, it's going to be 1 because it is, in fact, a 0 result. If we do, say, negative 10 minus 0, we get negative 10. That's going to be 1 because for the sign flag, because it is negative, the sign bit is 1. And it's going to have a 0 flag of 0 because it's not 0. Questions or any of these results for SF and ZF. Okay. So you might say, well, we talked about subtract in this. What is compare? So compare is a subtraction that just forgets to write to the destination rate general purpose register. So if we do compare RAX and RBX, this is the same as subtract RAX, RBX, except it doesn't change RBX. So we can think of it as a compare, just sets the flag values based on what the result, it computes the result, figures out what the flag values are, changes those, but it forgets to write to the destination normal register. And there's a similar instruction you might see called test, which does a bitwise AND in the same way. So the normal, there's an AND instruction. We'll talk about what a bitwise AND is in a few weeks. The context you'll usually see it in is that test RAX RAX. The result is RAX, and it's going to set the condition codes based on that. So you'll commonly see this used to test if a value is 0 by compilers. So questions? Yeah?
Does So this is still setting the condition codes?
This is still setting the condition codes? Yes. Yeah, so the purpose of compare and test instructions, they only set condition codes. The compare instruction does a subtraction, but it doesn't, it only sets the condition codes with it. The test instruction does what's called a bitwise AND, which most importantly, if you AND something with itself, you always get itself, and it only sets the condition codes with it. Other questions? Yeah.
What does it set the codes to?
It sets it based on the results of the subtraction or the bitwise AND. So if the result is 0, it's going to set the 0 flag to 1. If the result is not 0, it's going to set it to 0. If the result is negative, it's going to set the sign flag to 1. If the result is not negative, it's going to set the sign flag to 0. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does the bitwise AND do?
What does the bitwise AND do? So we're going to talk about this a lot in a few weeks when we talk about WSI operation. So it basically does an on every pair of bits of its two operands, it does an AND operation, which means the result is going to be 1 if and only if the corresponding bits of the two operands are 1. Which happens if we AND something with itself, we always get itself, which is what you'll see most for the test instruction. We'll talk later in the semester about why the processor would provide this AND operation. It turns out it is actually very useful. Yes?
So you can do any arithmetic operation after comparing them.
The question, you can do any arithmetic operation off of the compare and it would store the result? No. Compare always does a subtract.
So why is there a subtract after the compare?
So I was just saying, question, why did they write a subtract after the compare? I'm just saying that these two things are the same, except for what happens to the results. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I said, instructions work. Most instructions set condition codes, and I would say most instructions that compute settings set condition codes. We have our two instructions that only set condition codes, which are compare and test, and there are some instructions that don't change condition codes, and someone asked about LEA. LEA is listed as one of them, and move is also another one. You might say move computes a value. Well, not as far as condition codes are concerned. And all the control flow instructions, jump, call, return, etc., conditional jumps, they also don't change the condition codes. So that means you can run those instructions and the condition codes will remain the same. I wouldn't necessarily recommend taking advantage of this, but that's how it's defined. And as far as figuring out that LEA and move and return also don't change the condition codes, well, the way I know is because the processor's manual says so. Like, at some point, it's an arbitrary decision, right? Which ones do and do not. Because, like, there's certainly an argument to say, oh, but LEA computes something, it should change the condition codes. Or move even computes something, it should change the condition codes. Or call computes a stack address. But, yeah, they don't change the condition codes. That's just what the processor designers decided. Okay, so questions about what sets condition codes? Okay, so that gets us to our sort of more typical example. So this is the same as our example in subtract, except this time I just don't change RBX. So RBX is still going to be 20 after this, rather than 30, but we're going to have the same result as when we had a subtract instruction. We're going to compute the number 30. In both cases, it's just that sometimes we only are using the number to decide what happens later on with, say, that conditional jump. So you might say, why is it useful to have these condition codes be set by all sorts of instructions and not just compare and test? Because when you've looked at assembly, you've probably certainly seen that usually if we want to, you know, check if something is, you know, greater than or less than, we do a compare. We don't use a subtract or something like that. And as far as sort of why it might be useful, I think this probably illustrates sort of what's going on. So if we have a loop here that counts down from 99 to 0 and then finishes, one way we might write it is we have our loop counter in R12 here. I subtract 1 from R12 and then I check if it's 0 now. And if so, I go back to the beginning of the loop if it's greater than or equal to 0. But it turns out that because our result of this compare instruction, this is computing the R12 minus 0, and that's the same thing as the result of the subtract instruction, which is the sort of R12, the new R12, which is the old R12 minus 1. Right? The results are the same value in both cases. So the condition codes were already set correctly by that subtract instruction in the exact same way as comparing to 0 would be. So I don't have to compare to 0. I could just do a jump greater than or equal to right after the subtract that I already need to do to keep track of my loop index. So this is probably sort of why processor designers thought condition codes were a cool idea, because you kind of get, you know, the comparisons for free in some cases. Yeah?
Can we look at this as condition codes as sort of a shortcut?
Can we look at this as condition codes as sort of a shortcut? That's, I guess, one way of looking at it. Another way of thinking about it from the hardware is that in the hardware, we're going to have kind of some special circuit like the check is something zero anyways. And probably the philosophy was, well, let's just use that all the time. We have to have the circuit anyways. You know, let's just run it all the time and let you use the results. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So we have our sort of probably the reason why we want non-compare instructions to set condition codes. So let's do a little exercise with condition codes. Here. So if there's no overflow in this example, what is SF and ZF? What are the possible values? Who would like some more time? Okay, a few people. What? Yes. Could be multiple. Okay, who would like some? Okay, so you'll still need a little more time. Who likes some more time now? Not that many. Okay, so let's start with who thinks A is possible? Okay, who thinks B is possible? Who thinks C is possible? Well, who thinks D is possible? Okay, so we have most people think A and B are possible. And we have less consensus about C, and most people don't think D, but maybe a few. So I kind of wrote down what the operations are sort of here. But first, sort of a high-level thing, if we think about the condition codes, does our value for the condition codes come from? And, well, there's two instructions here which set the condition codes. We have our subtract and our add. The last one that runs is the add. So the final value of our condition codes is going to be based on that add instruction. Yes, they'll have been set to something else by the subtract, but that's not going to matter because the value that we actually see will be based on the add instruction, because it's the last one that runs. And if we look at the computation that's performed here, sort of I've represented the initial values of D and C as the letters D and C and put a little apostrophes next to them to represent the next value. So initially, D is a copy of C. Then we subtract 1 from that, so D is a copy of C minus 1. And then we add that, so C minus 1, which is here, to C. So we have C minus 1 plus C, which if we do some algebra is going to be 2C plus 2C minus 1. So the questions we have here are, can this be, so for the sine flag, can it be negative? Can it be positive? And for the zero flag, can it be zero and can it be non-zero? And so for can it be negative and positive, it's pretty simple to come up with examples of values of C, which would make our final arithmetic result 2C minus 1 be negative or positive. So if it's 0, we're going to get negative 1. If it's 1, we're going to get 1. So that's an example where the sine flag is 1 for negative 1 and 0. So both are both possible. And if our result is not 0 at the same time, which is true in those cases, we'd have the 0 flag be there. So an example here is, for the first case, is if C equals 1, we have 2C minus 1 equals 1, which is greater than or equal to 0, so it's not negative, and not equal to 0. So that would get us this first case. And when C equals 0, we get this second case, where our result is 1 equals negative 1, which is not 0, but is negative, so we have a sine flag of 1. So then there's a question of, can it be 0? Can the 0 flag be true? And if we look at that, well, we want to solve 2c minus 1 equals 0. If we try to solve that, we see that c just has to be 1 half. That's hard to do in an integer, so that's not possible. So both of these aren't possible for that reason. Questions? Yeah. The question is the zero flag looking at the result as signed or unsigned? So for the zero flag, it doesn't matter. Because signed zero and unsigned zero in the way we do arithmetic are the same. The question is D not possible because 0 is always is never negative? Yes, D is not possible in any case, no matter what the code is. Well, not no matter what the code is that does adds and subtracts. There is like a way of like load values into the condition codes that you could hypothetically do. There's an instruction for that. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so talk briefly about things that you should know for 2150, but just, you know, using conditional instructions and translating from C to assembly. So if I have this C code here and I want to translate it to assembly, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, personally, I just try to translate it first to this kind of C with if and go to. And why would I do that? Well, because when I've done this, now every line here kind of corresponds directly to an instruction or a short sequence of instructions. So this kind of if go to, I know I can represent with a compare and a conditional jump. This go to here, I can represent with a jump. And also it happens that this is valid C code, not that I recommend using the go to feature of C very often. And so I can go through this line by line and just convert it to a series of instructions to implement the corresponding operations. So questions on this conversion from this process for converting C code into assembly code when we're dealing with conditionals? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. Check with the neighbors. Who'd like some more time? Okay. Great. So let's see. So who thinks A is correct? Thinks B is correct? C? D? Okay. None of these? People, no clue? Okay. So let me go through what happens here. So first of all, we better have, if we kind of look at this code, one thing we can think from a high level is we better have a subtract, an add somewhere in there. And that kind of eliminates C and C because we have an extra addition that's kind of happening somehow. Doesn't make much sense. And I say, okay, our first operation, it looks like this, RBX minus equals REX. Our second one, RCX, we get added RBX to it. And then based on that result being compared to zero, we do something. And you think of this as jump if last result equals zero. And so if the last result equals zero, we don't run the add. Which is not what any of these things try to do. They're all checking if something's equal and running the add. So none of them are right, but it is A if we flip the compare. Some questions? On here. Okay, so I guess we're out of time, so next time Serge will finish up assembly and we'll talk about some new topics.